Dear listener, Ada here. Poetry Theater is back on this spring solstice, and as a season opener, I'd love to offer you a conversation that took place last fall at the university where I teach. This is a conversation between Dr. Reagan Penaluna and my colleague, Tammy. Dr. Penaluna is the author of How to Think Like a Woman, Four Women Philosophers Who Taught Me How to Love the Life of the Mind. The conversation between Dr. Penaluna and Tammy is largely based on questions shared by our students who read the book during the term, and it ranges from contemplative pleasure and suffering to the intersections of journalism, philosophy, community, and education. I hope that you enjoy this conversation as much as I do, and I look forward to bringing you a surprising, entertaining second season of Poetry Theater. Be kind to yourself.
To begin, my name is Tammy Root. I am one of the instructors here at Siena Heights, and I would like to introduce Reagan Penaluna. She is a writer with a master's degree in journalism and a PhD in philosophy. Previously, she was an editor at Nautilus Magazine and Guernica, where she wrote and edited long-form stories and interviews. A feature she wrote was listed in The Atlantic as one of the 100 exceptional works of journalism. Her book, How to Think Like a Woman, is the most anticipated book of the year at Lit Hub and The Millions, and a New York Times Editor's Choice. She lives in Brooklyn with her family, so please welcome Dr. Penaluna.
It's a pleasure to be here. I'm really grateful for the invitation and the chance to get to speak with you, with all of you. I'm just going to, I'll say a few things about my project, which I know you're all fairly familiar with, which has really moved me. And I love the questions that I've received in advance. And so I'm looking forward to this time with you right now. And the story of the book, as you know, right, is about my way into philosophy. I grew up asking the big questions. I grew up in a religious household, and I wanted to know, what is the nature of the universe? Is there a God? What is God like? What is my relationship to this world that we live in? How should I live? And these questions were burning in me. And even though I had eventually left my faith, when I was getting my bachelor's degree, I decided to major in philosophy. That was a very easy decision for me to do, and I loved it. And I continued on to graduate school in philosophy. And it was there that I chose to focus on the great philosophers of all time, the history of philosophy. I wanted to read the actual books that these greats had written. This was very important to me. I didn't want it to be something that I learned through, secondhand through another scholar. I wanted to deal with these great texts. And so I wanted to read Plato. I wanted to read Aristotle. I wanted to read Kant. And this is what I did. And I spent 4 years of my graduate work doing this. What surprised me, there were a few things. One was that some of these philosophers didn't have very nice things to say about women. And that's growing up as a woman in this world, these are things you're sort of used to, unfortunately, right? But I didn't expect that in, these works by these brilliant thinkers. And so I coped with it, and I said, I'll still continue on. So after about 4 years, I came to write, I had to declare a topic for my dissertation, and I wasn't inspired. And I started to realize that this is probably because of, how it felt to be a woman in this field. And that was something that I didn't want to admit to myself for a long time. I always thought of myself as very tough. I thought of myself as sort of free from those concerns. I had been raised to believe that my generation was the generation that, because we could go to college, because we could go to university, because we could do what our mothers and grandmothers couldn't. We were therefore equal to our male peers. And so when I came across personal experiences that suggested otherwise, when I came across these comments in these great texts, I really started to feel that this wasn't true. And so that sort of blew my mind. And I thought of leaving the field until I discovered one day in a footnote, this woman philosopher from the early modern period, which is like 16th, 17th century. So contemporaries of John Locke, Thomas Hobbes, Rene Descartes, these great thinkers. And I couldn't believe it. And as I looked into her work, I discovered that she was actually really interested in not just philosophy and the big questions of philosophy as I had learned about them, questions about knowledge and God, but also questions about the condition of women and why is it that women are, they struggle? Why is it that they're not supported socially and so on? And that surprised me. And I became very interested in what you could call is the woman question, the condition of women and how to improve it. And the more I looked into it, I found other women philosophers. Some of them were interested in traditional philosophy and some of them were really interested in the woman question also. And for some who touched on the woman question, it actually was the most significant question in their opus. And so those were the philosophers that I found myself drawn to. So I wrote my dissertation on a few of them and continued on. And I found through my own personal life too, being a woman, identifying as a woman, that a lot of the things they talked about, their experiences resonated with my own. And that's when I started to realize something is really wrong about the state of philosophy. If it, to be a woman, half of humankind, sort of questions that you ask yourself by growing up in this world are not being asked by the most critical, serious discipline, then there's something wrong with it. So my book is about the story of the erasure of women thinkers from the history of thought. I discovered, right, as you know from my book, and particularly the chapter Bedtime Stories, where I do a rundown of women philosophers around the world throughout history, discovered that the canon is not actually dead white men. There are women philosophers everywhere and numerous women philosophers talking about all sorts of things. So that was shocking. So my book is kind of a story about the erasure of women. How does this happen? What sort of mechanisms are at work that we can forget again and again, that history forgets? That's a nice way to put it, that women were there. And so it's also a question, my book is a question about why is the woman question not really considered a serious philosophical question? And by the woman question, what I mean is really questions about the experience of being a woman. Why are these sorts of experiences that some or many women find themselves in, such as the experience of being oppressed or the experience of being a mother, the experience of nurturing, why are these sorts of questions not part of the main philosophical agenda? So that became very curious to me, and I think it's a major problem. And yeah, and I think ultimately, I really, the more I've stepped away from academia, right? So I left academia 10 years ago, partly because the job market is very difficult. And I had fallen in love with someone who lives in New York. And I now have a husband and a family in New York. And I didn't care enough about academia to uproot myself and my family. But what I started to realize since I've left, I have sort of this really interesting critical distance on the field. And I realized that in philosophy, you are taught to really indulge in contemplative pleasure. And Aristotle talks about this in the opening of his Metaphysics, which is probably the most famous book in philosophy, right? In the first few words of that book is all humans by nature desire to know. And this is because we're curious creatures, but it's also because curiosity is pleasurable. Like, it's actually, right? That's why we're all here. This is why we go to college, partly, right? Not just for a job, but it's why we read literature. It's why we should read it. One of the main reasons is for this pleasure that we have in using our minds. But philosophy is more than that, I think. It's not just about contemplative pleasure. I think it's also about contemplative suffering. And certain questions that philosophers ask do fit that category, but they're often the questions that we don't generally, as philosophers, feel comfortable asking. And those are questions about the mistreatment of women and the mistreatment of people of color, and so on and so forth. So the more distance I got on the field, the more I began to see how the story of philosophy was shaped to sort of push away those questions that are more troubling and problematic in order to perpetuate a very unequal lifestyle, to perpetuate the status of these men at the upper levels of society who could continue to enjoy this contemplative pleasure. But anyway, so I'll leave it at that. I know you have questions, and I would love to hear some of those.
Yes, thank you. We asked our students to compile questions as they were reading each section of your book, and we got a lot of great questions. So I will ask them to you and answer them how you see fit. So out of the four main philosophers that you wrote about, which one would you like to meet and what would you want to say?
That's a really fun one. It's fun because I feel I've spent so much time with them in my head. And so I'm really curious about whether that idea I have of them is accurate, how accurate it is, you know? But I think the one I immediately think about, because I'm often asked this question in different forms, you know, like, who's your favorite and why? And it's sort of that question for me. But I think it's Mary Astell. Because her philosophy of, you know, creating a space for women that is intended to cultivate their intellects in absence of any disparaging comments, in absence of the oppression of society, in order to make them confident in themselves and to be in touch with their true selves, right? So I think that sort of message is so powerful and still relevant today for any individuals to sort of feel that their voice doesn't matter, or have a lot of self-doubt. I think it's a really important message. And it's amazing to me how crystal clear it was for her. And it's so concrete. She wanted to create this female academy where women could go and study together. And but she was also personally interesting. I mean, she never married. She stayed single. And I think part of that could be because she wasn't interested in men, full stop. We don't have any, you know, unequivocal evidence of this. But she was also really brave. You know, she took a carriage from her home in Newcastle down to London all on her own at 21 and struck out to be a philosopher, to make a living doing this when no woman had ever done anything like it. So just tremendous bravery. And I want to see what she's like, you know, and the little evidence we have is she was very brassy. She, you know, would pretend she wasn't home if someone was coming to visit her and she was writing, you know, and they'd knock on her door and they'd be like, Mary, are you there? And she'd be like, no, I'm not, you know. So what I think I'd want to do is just like follow her around, like trail her, shadow her, and see what her everyday existence is like. And then maybe at the end of that day of like following her around everywhere and spying on her, I would have a dinner with her. And I hope she would have a beer with me. They drank beer like water. So And I would want to know if she and Damaris Masham, this other woman I write about, if they really were enemies, as many of us suspect they were, intellectual enemies, and whether they ever met in person. I'm so curious.
Oh, interesting, because those are things that I'm not sure that I caught in the book. So that's cool that you would say that. One question that a student had that I want to know personally as well is the cover of this book. First of all, just grabbing. That's how I sometimes will choose a book just based on how it looks. And my students all ask me, and I'm like, put that in your questions for God. Petaluna, she will answer them for us. So how and why and what's the backstory and anything you can tell us about the cover of this book?
So it was like 4 years ago, and I think I was on Instagram or something. I love the art on Instagram. It's like one of the few redeeming things about that social media. But and I came across, so the artist's name is Eva Yushkevitz, and she is a contemporary artist, and she's based in Poland. She has a young family, and so I came across one of these images, and she does many of these. So the style is like she takes 18th and 19th century portraits, like that famous artists have done, and she renders them nearly identical to what the artist had done, but the scale is much larger. So whereas the original portrait might be 2 by 3 feet or 3 by 4.5, hers are like 10 feet. They're huge. So she takes and blows them up. They're still paintings. And then she dramatically transforms the face of the women. And so in my cover, right, she has, this drapery. And in others, she has done like a fruit arrangement or like plants. In earlier series, they were mushrooms, which was really grotesque, but very powerful. And I was immediately grabbed by these images too. And I looked more into it, read some interviews that she had done and everything. And she realized when she studied art history and she looked through this period, how the artists would tend to treat the images of the men as if they were individuals. So you could easily identify, oh, that is John Sawyer. I can tell, he has that funny crooked nose and that little, droopy eye or whatever. But when it came to the women, they were all nearly the same. They were very doll-like, very generic. You would lose that sense of person, right? Aiming for a more abstract idea of beauty, of, something objective, something satisfying to the male gaze. And this bothered Eva, the artist. And so what she wanted to do was to take that back, take that away. And so she covered these women so you could no longer objectify them in that way, right? But also by covering up, it creates a mystery, right? It's like, well, what's underneath? Who is there? And that was her intention, I found, is to point to the mystery in women. Like, who are they really, right? Who are these women? Who were they? And it's sort of part of our job as feminists or as art feminist artists or feminist writers, historians, to point to that erasure of women or that sort of generalization of women, and to essentially, right, say that it the time has come to deal with this erasure of women. And so I wanted to do that in my book because I think that happens to women in philosophy. Like, women are objectified in philosophy. It's not their bodies so much as it is their minds. Women's minds become this second class thing, and therefore this subordinates them overall. And so we have this very generic idea of woman when we read the texts of great philosophers. And when a woman knows, but any person knows that we are much more than our stereotypes, right? We're individuals. And so that is the goal of the book, is to really try to draw out the individuality of these women by saying there is a mystery here. There's been a mystery that the men didn't answer, and these women are philosophers are trying to point at something deeper, something more textured, and I'm trying to do the same too.
Well, thank you. I know for me, just the cover of the book kind of brought out the questioning. As soon as I saw it, I started questioning even before I began reading the book. So I enjoyed that. So thank you. And I know my students did as well. One student, and I'm going to kind of mesh this question together, wanted to know how long it took you to write this book. And now that it is published, is there anything that you would change?
Good question. So technically, I signed a book contract in the summer of 2018, and I submitted the draft of the book in 2021. It was published 2 years later, right? But there's a lot of production that happens between, and COVID had thrown off publishing schedules quite a bit. So, you know, I'd say about three and a half years. But I've been thinking about this book for far longer. So writing isn't always the process of actually sitting down and writing. I feel like I'm a writer when even when I'm reading material, because I'm always thinking about my project that I'm working on. But these women, I knew I wanted to write about them around when I was writing my dissertation. I thought, wow, these women deserve to be more known than by five scholars. Right? I think everybody should know that there were women philosophers, that there were women way before the 20th century defending women's rights, women's rights to education, women's dignity, and so on and so forth, women's autonomy. So that, you know, that was much longer. That was 2007, 2008. I knew I wanted to do something. And it took a long time for me to really figure out the structure. And it was my voice when I realized, oh, wait, I need to be a character in my book. That's when it all started to come together. And that wasn't until 2016 that I sort of unlocked that part of the puzzle. So there's a timeline. Would I change anything? I mean, so the paperback is coming out in March. I've already changed a few things, tiny corrections, you know, like, oh, there's this fact that's wrong. You know, the reviews are in. I really have had one brutal review and I don't really agree with it. So that's fine. I think the only thing that I wonder about is actually the beginning, the prologue. It's a very intense, in your face. There's a lot of statistics. And sometimes I wonder if that should have been an epilogue, you know, and just start the book off right with the story. With me in the classroom, with my professor. I wonder sometimes if it would have made the book more of an accessible read, if more people would have worked their way through it. But I don't know. I actually don't know if that ever has stopped anybody, but it's something I, as a reader, have wondered about myself. But I don't know. If anyone wants to write me a note and let me know if I'm right or wrong about that, I'd enjoy reading that.
You just gave me a discussion question for the end of the semester. So thank you. I was so focused, I got off the question. So how did you, well, first I want to say that I do appreciate in the academic world having factual with your personal memoir. I've never, and I read a lot. I don't read as much as Tony, but I read a lot. And that was such a nice mix. For me, it made it so enjoyable because I'm learning a little bit and then I'm learning about this person and tying it all together. And that's really what education should be about, right? Is how we connect into the world. So I thank you for that. Going to the next question and still on the book, how did you come up with this title? And did you consider any other titles?
There was an earlier title. The early title was the title of Mary Astle's book, A Serious Proposal to the Ladies. I loved that, right? I loved the idea that, you know, she was speaking directly to ladies, and that was like one of the first early modern texts I had ever read that was directly for women. very powerful message. So I thought that'd be cool to have that be the title. I don't love ladies so much. I don't call myself a lady. I don't know. It's just, that's a little too weird for me. So that part bothered me a bit. But it was, right before my agent and I started to send it out, we're like, she was like, what if it was something like, and this at this time there were other philosophy books out, like How to Be a Stoic and How to Be This. She's like, what if it was something like How to Think Like a Woman? I was like, yeah, that is right. So I can't take credit for it. But what I liked about it is how, you know, open to interpretation it can be, and how I actually don't think there's a way to think like a woman, to be clear. And I love that. It's very tongue in cheek, right? Great philosophers throughout history had very specific ideas about what it is to think like a woman. And this book, I hope at the end, my readers come away debunking that idea that there is one way, that there is a way to think like a woman. Like, that is the message I really hope people walk away with, is that women philosophers don't even agree about what it is to think like a woman. You know, the idea that there is a way to think like a woman is just a function of the ways that sexism has been codified in religion and in science and in philosophy and regurgitated over and over through millennia. It's like variations on a theme. It's like a Bach fugue, right? So I hope people can step away and see it for what it is. That thinking like a woman is, it can be very harmful. The same time, you know, not to contradict myself, but to play with this idea. I like this idea. I don't like black and white, right? So I do think that women, the similarities that we discern between women are a product of experience. And so if there is a way that we could say women think in common, it is because, I argue, the way that we've been conditioned, you know? And so that's another thing I hope becomes clear by the end of the book.
Yes, and our students just finished, and now we are meeting one of our objectives, and we're doing some comparing. So, thank you. Are you, you talked about a previous title. Is there a second book or another writing, something else? You're a writer. So,
yeah. Actually,
on the agenda next.
I'm like obsessed with this woman. I write about her in my book, In Bedtime Stories, Christine de Pizan, and The Book of the City of Ladies. She wrote this book in 1365. Oh, no, sorry. This is 1405. She was born in 1365, but 1405. And it's a book that is about many things, but it's about, it starts from this idea of what does a woman do when she's faced with sexism in the texts of her role models, right? And are the great individuals that she admires, and she's told that she's not good enough, she's not smart enough. You know, this refrain that we hear still today. Christine is talking about this in 1405, and she writes this book as a consolation. You know, it's not a, here's the thing, women are smart as men, right? She doesn't get into that debate. I think that that is a worthy exercise, but there's also another dimension to this, right? If we start to really take the woman question seriously, there's the question of what is the impact of asking a question such as, are women as smart as men, right? Often it's not really considered. Often it's just sort of like, if it's brought up, which is, you know, you have to read the room, but if it's brought up, it's often just sort of thrown out as like, oh yeah, this, is there a God? I don't know. Are women as smart as men? I don't know. Blah, 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 right? But those are two very different questions in terms of what sort of impact they can have on certain individuals, right? Women in particular. What does that mean if people are questioning your intellect? So Christine really addresses this and considers the impact on a woman's psyche. And the book is intended to be a book of consolation in order to bring women back to themselves when they're confronted with this, what she calls like a fountain of misogyny and sexism. And it's an incredible work in that way, and one that I think is still really relevant today. So that's what I'm working on right now. That's book number two.
Thank you. We have a preview. I appreciate that. So this really goes into my next question. So in your book, you address various aspects of gender equality and women's rights. Could you share some of the key messages or takeaways that you hope that we gain as readers?
Well, I think for me, like, it's such a historical book. And I think one is part of being, I do think that part of the solution to women's liberty and by extension equality is having a rich sense of women's history. Because there are patterns that repeat throughout history. And so it's not the case that their women were there to defend themselves against, you know, misogyny and sexism. And they actually were there, and they wrote incredible works in response to it. And not just women, but men. And I feel like that's actually a really important story to tell that I tried to tell in my book a few different ways about the role of feminist men in the, you know, promulgation of women's rights and equality. So like George Ballard was a historian, and his dying wish was to write this, you know, biography of great women thinkers and writers. And so I think those messages are actually really important when we're thinking about how to make this world a better world. And it's to see patriarchy as not all men. It's not all men that are like this, right? Actually, there's a lot of really awful women that promote sex, you know, sexism. And I do talk about them also in the book. So that was sort of my intention, is to say, this problem of patriarchy is a social problem. It's a social illness. And you can't say that it's all men. You can't say that all women are feminists, right? It's, you know, we have to be very careful and respectful and be better than what has, you know, what people have done and what people have said. We have to bring that nuance. Sexist pigs, I know plenty of women sexist pigs in history. So part of that, so I think the message is, right, it's complicated, and let's focus on patriarchy and not, it, there's no, male hatred is wrong. So, but also, again, you know, the message that debunk gender essentialism, you know, the book doesn't do this full stop, but it's really a tacit wish of mine to reveal through the patterns of history, through, you know, patterns we find in the history of science and philosophy, to show how just the same idea of women's inferiority is just sort of recycled over and over. And it's like the goalpost is always being moved. So women are like, okay, great. So we don't believe anymore that there's four human humors in the human body and that women have the more depressive type, right? The slower type, right? We're over that, right? Yeah, we're over that. But now we say that your hips are too big and your head is like a toddler, right? It's like, but that sort of awareness that, you know, that historical awareness, I think, is really important to see those patterns and to realize that probably let's really be all of us much more skeptical of these sort of ideas of gender differences and take more seriously the ways that conditioning really does stunt the courage, the confidence of individuals.
And I go a tiny bit off script, because what you were just saying made me think, when you first started writing this book, were you coming at the book, maybe it's more than one way, where you're like, I want to give credit to where these women philosophers were, and then it turned into about society and feminism? Or did you come at it from a feminist aspect and add in the philosophy, or was it a good mix?
It's like, yeah, it definitely evolved over time, Tammy. It was like, I mean, at first when I was into them, it truly was like, oh, wow, there's women. Wow, there's women in philosophy. But I had to write about them in a way that would be acceptable to my advisors. And what that means is you figure out what is going on in scholarship and you click into that, right? But the scholarship at that time, it's changed quite a bit over the last, 15 years. But it wasn't as interested in the woman question and the condition of women in the texts of these women. And so I focus on sort of slightly different issues. But the feminist stuff, my feminist read of them started to happen as I stepped away from them purely through an academic lens, which I found really interesting. I didn't take feminist philosophy as an undergrad or graduate student. It was not on offer. There were no women philosophers taught. So I can imagine somebody who did have that experience would have caught on to these sorts of things faster than I had, right? But it took me stepping outside of academia to really start to get that sort of perspective on, wow, the sort of things that I would call women's experience are things that they're interested in and things that they're articulating in a philosophical matter, but that are not being talked about in philosophy, right? And so that all came later. And that's when I realized that my voice had to be part of it too, to bring it all around.
Thank you. I want to hit on a couple more questions before we talk and see if there's some questions in the chat, but being mindful of time as well. Is there anyone in the book that you did not include that you would like to include? And I'm going to add a little more. Would you ever think about writing a second part to this book to include people you weren't able to include?
I love that question. Every day. Nearly every day, I'm like, oh, wow, there was this woman too. Oh, wow. So that's one thing, right? As I continue to mine history for these thinkers, I think they're going to end up in, the book with her. She writes a bunch of capsule biographies in her book. That's kind of part of a constellation. And so I'm going to probably do something like that in mine. So yeah, I guess it could show up. But also, I didn't really talk about any women philosophers beyond the 19th century, and that was really intentional. I stopped with Anna Julia Cooper, a Black American philosopher who studied in Paris at the Sorbonne. She was born a slave, and she had these incredible insights into gender dynamics, race dynamics. She had this really wonderful critique of philosophy that is really helped crystallize my relationship to philosophy. And she said this, and I don't want to digress too much, but I just want to say this and I'll go back. But she was like, let me just paraphrase here for a moment, but philosophers tend to believe that any question is, is safe in that you can ask anything you want. We're philosophers. We're kind of above politics. We're above society. We're above ethics, right? That's what it means to really inquire about the truth, right? You can ask whatever you want, no matter how offensive someone might find it or immoral, you're a philosopher. That's great until you're the person whom is constantly being undercut or questioned by these lines of questioning. It's not to say that they shouldn't be asked, right? It's not to say that these questions should be censored completely. It's that we need to bring a much different or a fuller sense of humanity to philosophy to do it responsibly. And so here's what Anna Julia Cooper said, which is the rights of philosophers are the rights of humanity. And I love that, right? It's like, you don't stop being human when you're a philosopher. And care for others is crucial to being a responsible philosopher. And I agree with her 100%. So going back to your question, which now I totally forgot because I just digressed. What was it?
I put the part two. Would you ever have a part two, maybe short story or something, or somebody that you would have wished you would have added to the book?
So, right. And so definitely there's a lot of people I think of before the 19th century. And it's like, I come up, there's so many. And there's people that I wrote about in bedtime stories and like, oh, there's pieces I wish I would have included. Like I talked about Sor Juana Inez de la Cruz, this Mexican philosopher, 17th century. And she has a cookbook. And in her cookbook, she's working with eggs. And Aristotle famously said that women are inferior to men and they're biologically inferior to, and their eggs are part of the reason, you know. And she was like, so here you have Sor Juana Inez de la Cruz. She's cooking with eggs and she does all these amazing things with them, right? She's like, she's making the craziest cookies and cakes. And she's like, oh my gosh, Aristotle, he would have had so many more ideas if he just would have been a baker. It's like, oh my God, that's like so genius. I wish I could have put that in the book. But I only discovered that later. So, but I didn't want to go past the 19th century. I feel like people tend to know the women philosophers, you know, the 20th century, Hannah Arendt, Simone de Beauvoir, usual suspects, you know? So I just sort of, I wanted to go 19th century and backwards to talk about the people that we don't know as much about. Or like Wollstonecraft, even though we've heard her name, I want to tell a story about her as a philosopher, which is not often what gets told.
So going along those lines of back from the past, what advice would you give to your younger self as a philosopher or other women, young women, in philosophy? And did you learn anything about yourself while writing this book?
Oh yeah. But I love so the first part, like, oh yes, there's so much I wish I could have told myself. Oh my gosh. Young Reagan. Oh dear. Yeah, Reagan in graduate school. Maybe even Reagan in undergrad. And so what I did is the end of my book, I have this section where I imagine what I would have said to this professor. So there's this scene in my book, right? It's the opening of the book where I'm sitting in his class and he comes in, he's this famous professor, super intimidating. You know, everyone's afraid to speak in his class. If you do, you just basically get cut down, right? But he's gender equal about that, everybody, no matter who you are. But he's super brilliant. And, you know, he comes in, thick stack of papers, throws it on the desk. And he's just like, okay, today we're going to talk about the female drama in Plato. But before we do, we just have to ask, you know, why is it that there are no great women philosophers? Why is it that, you know, there aren't as many women in philosophy as men? We have to take seriously that women are inferior intellectually. And I just remember sitting there when he said that and just, I was frozen. I didn't know what to do, right? I'd never studied feminist philosophy. I had also never really felt that my future would be undercut by anyone I admired so deeply, which is very naive. Totally naive, but there it was. That was my moment. And it had a major impact, you know? And so what would I have told myself? Like, that's okay. Go start reading your feminist philosophy now. Find your allies, right? They were there. It's hard to see then. Didn't even know where to begin, right? Don't rush into marriage, Reagan. Don't do that. You're too young. 27 is still too young for you. You know, figure out who you are first. And if you don't even know what that means, then you need to really do that. And if things are really difficult, then maybe this isn't right. You know, I don't know. But definitely the allies, reaching out, you know, reaching out, finding professors that I could count on. I should have written letters to people outside of my department. I even toyed with the idea of leaving. Should have done it. Why not? All these things. Be more brave. Allies, that's key. Maybe it would have ended up the same, you know? I mean, who knows, but.
Any final words or thoughts that you would like to leave to all our students? I was going to make the assumption of age, but I don't know my students' age. I was assuming that they're all younger, anything for our students in the world learning this class, gone and finished your book, any final thoughts you would leave before I ask Tony if there's any questions?
Yeah, you know, thank you for reading. And I hope that you come away from this. If there was ever self-doubt about yourself, and this is for anyone of any gender, right? Like, I just think self-doubt affects us at all ages, right? And it's not an indicator of really anything. And that was a big realization for me in my book, right? We think if we doubt ourselves that we're somehow less than, right? It's somehow indicative of some essence. And it's truly not. Often it's very much a function of circumstance, or unfortunately oppression. And so set it to the side, find what you love, and dig, 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 question it all, question everything.
Thank you, Tony. I love the question part because our class is heavily based on discussion questions. So we are constantly asking each other questions. We start off with an initial question. There's always follow-up questions, lots of questions. So Tony, I'm going to hand
you
over.
No, Sean, there's nothing in the chat, although I would like to say, just to answer your question from the top, Doctor, now that you've said that, I wouldn't have thought about the introduction as the epilogue, but now that you've done it, I'm like, yeah, that's boss. I think that, because, you know, I love to just dump people in and like let them sink or swim. So I think if you started us with on your journey, with that way. But again, I loved it as it is. Obviously, here we are because I stumbled across this as an arc because of that cover. By the way, amazing. Thank you for that. Like, that has been an ongoing conversation between Tammy and Ada and I, and we discussed it in class as well. So, you know, no, there's not a... Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Just really quick about the cover. There's a piece in the New York Times. You guys can check it out, like a week ago, about this artist. And there's a bit in there about me and why I picked her for the cover too.
We will find that and we'll send it out to everybody. Link in the show notes, but link in the class notes, because we're going to share this for those students who couldn't make it because it is 1 o'clock on a Friday afternoon. So we will definitely, we're recording this because Dr. Pernolino has been lovely enough to let us do that. So I would just ask you one last thing is, and I know it's such a weird, because I'm looking at you and I'm asking you such a weird question, but like, you know, there's this idea about like being a role model. I feel that you are one. Was that remotely ever on your mind? Does that blow your mind a little that people read this and are like, she's boss, I want to be like her? Was that never your intention?
No.
It okay. Wasn't.
But it's interesting because I have a few friends who are in this sort of more self-help literature, you know, the cross of philosophy and self-help. And that has never felt like my home. I don't feel comfortable in that. So, and I think that's because I don't feel settled on anything, right? I very much approach things like in an unprogrammatic way. I don't know. I just feel like that's a healthier way for me to be a human being and to interact with others and to be open to the unexpected. You know what I mean? So that wasn't it. I mean, if it happens, I mean, that's flattering, you know, it's not expected or not an intention.
Well, that's makes it even better. This happened truly, truly. This happened because this has been a true honor. Pick us out, Tammy. Thank you again, Dr. Pennelly.
Yes,
thank
you. I wanted to give you a personal thank you. You talk about putting your doubt aside, and you are a role model to me. My teenage daughter was the one that said, Mom, just do it. And Tony was in my ear saying, just tell her that you're reading the book and you read it twice.
Thank you for reaching out, Tammy. I love being connected to you guys. You know, it means a lot to me too. So like, what better way to head into the weekend?